Hello and welcome to our Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System bonus call. And this is a call with Steph Jackson. And Steph is going to be sharing with us some amazing information about probiotics and organisms that most of us probably haven't heard before. It's some very specific targeted stuff. And I've listened to other speakers. I've, you know, listened to Gut Health, the Gut Healing Summit speakers, and a lot of them don't talk about, none of them talk about the stuff that Steph's going to be talking about today. Some of them will say, well, some people should take probiotics and some people don't do well and some people should eat fermented foods and some people don't do well, but nobody addresses the issue of why, of the particular organisms and how to choose those probiotics, the appropriate probiotics based on what the heck is going on down there. So I am thrilled to introduce you to Steph. Most of you know Steph already, but for those of you who don't, Steph Jackson is a health coach and she's a student in our nutritional endocrinology program. She's a functional nutrition coach in my ERC, Energy Recharge Inner Circle, and she works with some of the people there. And I just think she's amazing. She spoke at our Shine conference last year. I've invited her to come and speak at our Spring into Vitality conference. She just has an amazing perspective. She's a excellent researcher, and she has a really great way of putting things together. You know, in her previous life, before health coaching, she's a guitar teacher. She probably still does some of that, maybe with her son. And she has a degree in education. I think you have a master's, right? In educate curriculum development or something like that.
Yeah, I've got two.
Yeah, too. There you go. So she's a studier, and so she knows how to present things as well. So she knows how to put things together in a way that people can understand and really appreciate. She's the founder of the Core Reset Program, which some of the folks in this program have done, and she's just an amazing person. So I'm just going to let you get to know Steph Jackson. So thank you, Steph.
Thank you, Dr. Ina Reed. That is really nice. I'm so excited to be here. I'm really excited about this presentation. I got really excited putting these slides together. It's my first time really doing slides, and I actually really love it.
I do, too.
I hope you can see the slides.
Let me just tell them about seeing the slides, just in case
you're
not used to it. Off to the side. Well, once you log in on the web, if you're just on the phone, you won't see the slides, but the recording will have the slides. So if you're driving in your car or you're at the airport or whatever, and you can't see the slides right now, no big deal, but you will get a chance to listen to this again and you have a copy of the slides. So two things, off to the left-hand side, it'll say slides and you can download those slides and you can watch them. But once you got logged in, it should say webcast and then you should be able to see the slides on the screen. So I'd love to hear feedback and make sure that everybody can see them. I can also go back and click it on my own and make sure that those slides are showing.
Awesome. Yeah, so we're going to do, this is going to be a somewhat interactive call, so I would love it if people were on the phone or on the chat on the Join Me so that we could also exchange information sometimes and get questions and answers. And yeah.
Perfect.
So yeah. Okay, so yeah, we're here to talk about probiotics. And I'm sure that at this point, each of you know, as Dr. Rita Maria and I do, that the gut is really the root of so many health issues that we see. Yeah, some say the road to health is paved with good intestines. Yeah, so if, you know, during the beginning of this call, if anybody has any favorite probiotics that they like to use, I would love if you could type it into the comments, and we'll take questions later. Yeah. So I want to thank everybody for being here. You know, this is all totally new stuff. Every day there's something new in this field of digestion and digestive bacteria. It's totally exploding right now, and there are some people doing really exciting research, and there's almost too much to keep up with. And so working functionally with the gut and working functionally with bacteria right now requires that we have an open mind and that we're willing to look at new research on a daily basis and keep updated and change our opinions as enough new good evidence comes forward. And I'm not suggesting, you know, every new study, we just randomly change our approach. And definitely the basics are the most important thing. But, you know, if something comes up three or four times and it looks like a really good study and it looks responsible, then I think it's really good for all of us to be open-minded and to be willing to change. And I thank everybody for being here, because I know that you guys are on that boat with me. And I know that together we're going to be able to bring this knowledge further. So that makes me really excited to be here on this call. And I also just want to thank Dr. Rita Marie for having me here. This is a huge honor. It really is.
We're thrilled to have you, Steph.
Okay, so by the end of this bonus module, you will know three important digestive imbalances. So I love to take all this information and break it into categories so that when we see people and we kind of can get a picture of what the symptomatic picture looks like, we would know better which areas to start testing. We don't want to kind of give everybody all the tests when they walk through the door. And so we're going to talk about the three main kinds of digestive imbalance that you are maybe likely to see with chronic health conditions. So that's one thing. And you'll know five important invasive organisms. So these are my top five that I think are important right now. And there are so many, but these ones I see on a regular basis. And so it'll be great for you to be really familiar with them. We're going to talk about the most reliable testing for each of these bacteria or yeasts or parasites that we're going to talk about today. And then finally, we're going to, as promised, talk about 10 probiotic bacteria that can help with specific circumstances in the body. Okay. And we're going to talk a little bit about how to choose probiotics for the whole person. So the first type of digestive imbalance that we're going to talk about today is D-lactic acid overgrowth. And so this happens when bacteria produce too much of something called D-lactic acid. All bacteria produce either L-lactic acid or D-lactic acid. And the L-lactic acid is very easy for our bodies to metabolize. And the D-lactic acid, not so much. And so we still have, you know, our kidneys and our skin and everything. But the D-lactic acid has a tendency to build up in the intestinal tract and can actually build up in our blood and can actually change things in our brain, can, you know, I don't want to say damage the brain, but you can see people with brain symptoms, and one thing to look for is D-lactic acid overgrowth. And so a lot of the bacteria, even the probiotic bacteria that we can buy at the store, create D-lactic acid. And so this is a big deal if it's in the small intestine. So I think everybody on this call knows the pH of different parts of the digestive system. So let's just quickly make sure we've got that straight before we go forward with this lactic acid thing. So what about the small intestine? I'd like to just check the comments, see if anybody could tell me good pH for the small intestine.
Go ahead and type it in, everybody. So if you go, the best way to type stuff in and to be interactive during this is go to join.me. We'll be presenting on the Instant Health Seminar link. So if you're listening in and you're not seeing anything, you have to click there. But if you type it into the Join Me, we can interact. So who knows what the pH of the small intestine is? Anybody? And you can raise your hand if you're just on the phone and you want to share that as well.
Cool. Thanks, Lynn. Yeah, I would say even on the higher numbers of that. Mm-hmm. Lynn says 7.4. Yeah. Yeah. And so the large intestine has a much lower pH, is much more acidic. So when some of these organisms are in the large intestine, it's not that big of a deal. They're creating more of the ideal environment in there. But in the small intestine, where we need to be absorbing all of our nutrients, and we'll get into that in a little bit, we actually want the pH of that space to be a lot higher, more alkaline. And so if the bacteria are in there, and the probiotic bacteria can do this too, and they're producing too much D-lactic acid, then they're going to alter the environment in the small intestine. And this is a big deal. The pH in the small intestine really is regulated through our liver and gallbladder secretions. And, you know, so some of the food that's coming through is going to be kind of alkaline in nature because it's been doused with bile. And the thin layer of acidic bacteria on our skin there is going to help to pull the alkaline minerals in and break them down for our bodies to absorb. But if the whole thing is acidic, then we're not going to get that lovely exchange happening. And so absorption can be decreased. Yeah. So big deal.
Yeah.
And so with this, like you might see someone who has gas and bloating and other symptoms that otherwise might be known as SIBO. And in a lot of cases, when somebody comes to you and they say they have SIBO, this is an underlying root cause that needs to be looked at, in my opinion. So yeah, they're producing too much D-lactic acid. There's insufficient organisms breaking down the D-lactic acid. A lot of soil-based organisms, or a couple soil-based organisms that can live in our large intestines, do break down D-lactic acid. So our bodies might not be able to break it down, but other organisms can. And of course, we can't buy these as of yet in probiotic form. There's a bacteria called E. halli, H-A-L-L-I-I. And actually, I do know that somebody patented that bacteria sometime in the last few months. So my guess is that there is going to be a product coming, which I think is cool, because it could help a little bit with this situation. So right now, all we can really do is balance the bacteria and work on keeping them where they belong and work on the function of the small intestine and getting the pH back the way that it needs to be for function. Yeah, so some things you might see, I talked about brain symptoms, adrenal fatigue, a lot of adrenal fatigue with this. I'm not sure what causes what the causality is, but there's a lot of kind of documented adrenal fatigue and D-lactic acid overgrowth together. We don't know who caused what, but this is a pattern that you might see. So important to have a look at. Okay, yeah, so a couple other things that I did forget that I thought of while we were doing this, the phone dance just now. Changing that environment in the small intestine can affect motility. Like it's kind of a downward spiral. So there are bacteria that are changing the environment, which is affecting motility, which keeps them there longer so they can grow more in an environment which they like, which further affects motility. And as you can see, you kind of end up with a bit of a situation, or a person could end up with a bit of a situation with this overgrowth. So that's what D-lactic acid overgrowth is. Yeah, and I would love to talk more about that another time.
Okay. Well, that's a whole conversation in and of itself.
It really is, and I think really important one. So a couple of the bacteria that are very important in this D-lactic acid imbalance are E. coli, Enterobacter, and Klebsiella is important. I wanted to cover them more in depth in this conversation, but I feel like covering the E. coli and the Enterobacter, you're going to get a good picture of how this looks. And Klebsiella, I'm hoping that you'll have the tools after this to look into a bit further. I felt like there were some things that were more important to cover. So the E. coli, they can be aerobic or anaerobic, depending on the situation. And so just to be super clear, aerobic means they can handle being in an oxygenated environment. And it doesn't necessarily mean being exposed to air. It can just be an oxygen-rich environment, even in water or anything like that. Or they can also be anaerobic. And anaerobic would mean they die when they're exposed to oxygen, basically. And so they can eat sugar, or they can rely on fermentation completely in an anaerobic environment to survive. And so they kind of have the upper hand in that respect. You know, I'm not going to go really deeply into the things that kill bacteria, because I know that that's been covered, but a lot of the pesticides and water with chemicals in it, or, you know, anything that we might be exposed to, antibiotics that can kill some organisms, might not be able to kill E. coli. Because they can survive in a variety of environments, whereas some other organisms, when they're exposed to oxygen, a lot of our good bacteria are anaerobic. And so if we do something that exposes them to oxygen, or if we take antibiotics, they might die, but E. coli might not. E. coli also has a double cell wall, and so they have quite the defenses. So they're flexible and they have two shields to protect them. And so a lot of the time when people say that antibiotics kill the good bacteria but not the bad bacteria, and you're kind of going, well, I don't know, they're probably killing everything. This is an example of one situation where the bad guys, quote unquote, and we'll come back to that in a bit, can outlive the very beneficial bacteria in our digestive systems. So E. coli is not a bad bacteria. They're actually a beneficial bacteria. However, they are also linked to urinary tract infections. It's the most common bacteria involved in urinary tract infections. And a lot of them are now resistant to the antibiotics that are used to treat urinary tract infections. They're the most common bacteria involved in mastitis, other than the yeasts. There are hundreds of subspecies. And just for an example of how they're kind of good and also not so good, they produce K2, which we totally need. They produce glutathione, which is awesome. But they also produce beta-glucuronidase and D-lactic acid. And so beta-glucuronidase can be a risk factor for colon cancer. So just so you know what that is. So, you know, they're neither good nor bad. They just exist with us. And when they're in the wrong place and things are out of balance, then, that's an issue. We talked about resistant, and they can also feed candida, or they can exacerbate a candida problem. And we'll talk more about candida later, but it's just important to remember that E. coli can feed candida. E. coli pre-digests sugars and then kind of spits them out in a way that candida actually prefers. It's less work for candida to eat when E. coli is around because they're putting food on the table. You still there?
Yeah, lots of stuff. I have myself muted so I don't have my background noise interrupting. But and you mentioned here that some strains have been found to cause obesity. That's kind of scary too.
Yes, it totally is. And so what they actually did for this particular study is they took these germ-free mice and they had a strain of E. coli, one of the hundreds of strains of E. coli. They gave it to half of the germ-free mice, and they got obese.
Wow.
So there you go. They're able to actually make them obese by giving them E. coli. It's a big deal. E. coli is also, and again, we don't know, you know, any cause factors here, but E. coli is also very much associated with celiac disease. And, you know, I know that, you know, there's no really good study right now saying that there's any bacteria that causes celiac disease or that, you know, gluten exacerbates a bacterial imbalance. But I kind of bet my money that gluten exacerbates a bacterial imbalance, just to let you know. Yeah, but anyway, E. coli and celiac disease are very common, very hand in hand. So if you have a client who has had celiac or been diagnosed with celiac or even is gluten sensitive, and they've eliminated gluten, they're not getting better, things are still a little bit off, definitely checking for an overgrowth of E. coli, I think, would be warranted for sure.
Good idea.
Yeah. So let's have a look at how E. coli might show up on some tests.
Okay.
All right. So this is a very pretty Genova comprehensive stool analysis. Right. It's very pretty. It has these pretty graphs. I don't have much to say about this slide, although it's nice. So the next slide will kind of show you what you would see on the test itself. Right. So I actually do find this quite useful. Actually, this was one from like a couple days ago. And so I put it in. The person in this situation, you can kind of see from this test that they're not absorbing their fats very well because there's a lot of fat in their poop, basically. So those levels are high and they're not absorbing it very well. And so that might give you some clues, like in a kind of dark area where we're just looking for some clues to put things together. This test does give you a lot of clues as to things that might be going on in the digestive system. So I like that. Yeah. And you can see at the bottom,
Clarify, Michelle is wondering, she just wants to clarify that, so if E. coli, which lives in everybody's large intestines, is okay when it's in balance. It's just a problem when it's either out of balance in the large intestine or when it's creeped up into the small intestine. Is that correct?
You got it. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect.
Yeah, you got it. And they're so good at producing the D-lactic acid that they can be a really good catalyst for imbalance. So some other bacteria might creep up into the small intestine and may also be a problem if they're overgrown, but E. coli is often the culprit. Like I know at the SIBO Center, they say there are the three bacteria that are usually responsible for SIBO, and they're the ones that I was mentioning, the E. coli, the Enterobacter, and the Klebsiella. And so there will be other bacteria in there, but they'll follow suit. And the E. coli usually starts it. Does that help?
Good clarification. And I was going to ask, so if you do a stool analysis and you see an overgrowth of E. coli, does that lend you to be suspicious that there may be some SIBO going on?
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And I might not use that language with my client, you know, but I might say, you know, do you experience, or what happens after you eat? You know, and then I'm trying to find out if they're experiencing gas and bloating.
Yeah.
And if they are experiencing gas and bloating after they eat, like within the first couple hours, and they do have this bacteria, then I have to make a choice as to really the nature of my client. If they want to go get a diagnosis for something and do that and go through SIBO, or like it just depends on their mental state at that time, actually. Like,
that's a really good clarifying point, Steph.
Yeah.
Because I don't think people think about that so much. It's like, do you really need the diagnosis, or would you then proceed with your recommendations to them based on your thinking that it might there might be some SIBO going on? And as opposed to saying to them you might have SIBO, which could really put a whole, you know, psychological twist on them, right? Like, oh, no, that's terrible, horrible, right?
Totally. Yeah, I think, yeah, there are two different ways to look at it. And a lot of clinicians right now are saying that, you know, 40% of people with chronic disease have undiagnosed SIBO. Or you could just kind of think, you know, it's not, I don't want to say not that big of a deal, but whatever you call it, you could call it like purple banana. You have purple banana. If you know what to do with the purple banana, you're fine.
Exactly.
Does that make sense?
It totally does. I'm a person who doesn't, I don't like to label things. I like to just deal with the person and the imbalances in the person versus labeling. Because I think because of our society, our medical system, that labeling then puts that fear into a person, and that gives them the hopelessness feeling. So I prefer to just work with people and say, hey, I'm seeing an imbalance of these bacteria, and here's some of the things we can do to clear it up.
Right. Yeah. And also as a drawback, and I'm totally in favor of using the antibiotics if that's the right thing for your client, but they are very expensive. And there's about a 40% relapse. And I don't know about you, but when I spend $1,000 on something and it doesn't work,
I
feel kind of discouraged. A little pissed, yeah.
Discouraged was a nicer way to say it, but yeah. And the thing about SIBO, it's not just about killing the bacteria. It's like determining why it's overgrown there. How did it get there? You know, and we go through that in the SIBO module in this program, which was just released last week. So please make your way down to that. We go through that in very great detail. But you have to know, why is it overgrowing, right? Yep. Is it overgrowing, and is it leaking up into the small intestine from the large because of an incompetent ileocecal valve? Is it not making its way all the way down and migrating into the large intestine because of a problem with the migrating motor complex? And if you don't know what a migrating motor complex is, you'll learn it in that SIBO module. And also,
is
the immune system a problem? So you don't want to just say, oh, SIBO, get the antibiotics, let's be done with it, because, as Jeff said, super expensive, 40% relapse, but also you're not addressing the root cause.
Exactly. Like, it depends on your perspective, but my perspective is that the bacteria are neither good nor bad, but that they can be a reflection of the weaknesses within the system. You know, just like, you know, they can show us the weaknesses within the system. And if we're not addressing the system itself, then I think we've missed the boat. Yeah.
And when you say they're not good or bad, meaning that they can be very good if they're in balance and they're living in harmony with the rest of the critters down there.
Right.
And if they're overgrowing and crowding out some of the other critters down there, that same good can turn into bad.
I just wanted to also say this person could use a little more bifidum. Really. Yeah. But okay, so let's go to the next page.
Point out, so I can use an arrow. Where did point out where the bifidum is for maculae?
So
okay, bifidum. Here we go.
Yeah.
So even though it's in the green, it's at the low end of the green, and that's not where we want it. Is that right? And compared to the lactobacillus and some of the others, which are a lot higher, we really should be wanting more bifidus. Is that right?
Right, totally. Okay. And the bifidus is going to create the environment in the large intestine in which that bacteria, the E. coli, can live. And those guys, again, are the ones that can consume the D-lactic acid. And so it can help to kind of just build a place of balance. Yeah.
Great. Okay. Let's just see if there's any questions before.
Yeah, this is the 401, BioHealth 401. This test, I mean, it's there are not a lot of bells and whistles. There's no little graph showing you how abundant you are. But I do find it to be very accurate. It gets the job done for sure, particularly for the parasites and the H. pylori, which we'll talk about later. But yeah, so that's what that one looks like.
Yeah, and it just doesn't give you as much. It doesn't give you the function of the gut. So there's times,
right.
And Steph and I kind of agree on this, where we might initially do this 401 or the 401H so we can see if there's any H. pylori. We could see what the big bugs are. We'd work on it, try to get rid of that H. pylori. This test happens to be the best test for H. pylori.
Yeah.
I've found it to be more accurate than the others. So we'll do this first and then start to work on that and then go back and on the follow-up maybe do something more like the Genova or the doctor's data, which we'll look at in a bit.
Yeah, so the doctor's data is my favorite, and so that's the next one.
Mine too.
Yeah, so this is what you might see on the doctor's data. And so this would be the first page where they kind of tell you what they've found. And I just want to draw your attention to the left, the third bacteria down on the left. And so it's an expected beneficial flora, but the E. coli has 4+. And so, you know, this is a different person. I use three different people. But so even on this one, even with the other bacteria in the Klebsiella, I would definitely address first, which you'll see on the right in the red. But I would be looking at that E. coli, even though it's in the green happy column. So I hope that's helpful. But this is something, like, this is a pretty typical one that I would see.
Yeah, that is helpful because, you know, we definitely, the Klebsiella is out of range. I just put a yellow highlight on it. But the E. coli, when you look at that, it's 4+, and it's not showing up as out of balance. But look at how it compares to the other, that like the lactobacillus and the bifidus. So
exactly.
It's clearly out of balance. And this goes back to nothing's good or bad. It's just the balance. And so if it's overarching, you know, and overpowering the others. But one last question before we go on. How would you build the E. coli without taking a probiotic?
Yeah, okay, so the honest truth is it's not even available in like soil-based organisms. This is complicated, but after healing leaky gut, I would consider taking something like a Prescript Assist with all those soil-based organisms. And when the main bacteria that you've identified that are overgrown have been brought into balance, I would then also consider adding as wide of a spectrum of bacteria from real fresh foods and cultured foods as possible. And that is the only way for us to get it right now. This might not be the right time to say this, but we all have totally different bacteria. So I betcha like we have that study or a few studies now that say that E. coli eats D. lactic acid. There's probably, there are just so many bacteria in the world. There's probably another bacteria that also eats D. lactic acid. We just haven't figured it out yet. We don't really know a lot about the system. We don't even know what we don't know. But we do know that some bacteria eat D. lactic acid. And so my perspective is to get as many local bacteria from fresh foods. I'm talking raw fruits and vegetables, local, and also to have cultured foods as much as possible. We don't really know more than Mother Nature at this point. And I think diversity is really key there to have the system working properly. Yeah.
Good stuff. Yeah, good stuff. Yeah. And it all goes back to, balance, 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 balance. And You can't just look at a lab test. We talk about this a lot in our other programs where we look at the other kinds of lab tests. You can't just look at the printout from a lab and say, oh, it's green, so it's okay. You have to look at the ratios between things. You have to look at the balance between things. And that's what we're after. Totally. We're after looking to get people in balance. And when you get people in balance, a lot of the symptoms go away. So we don't want to address symptoms or address diseases. We want to restore balance. And that's what we do.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I saw a question that said, so you would address the SIBO first before adding the cultured food. Absolutely. With the caveat that if you're using the right bacteria and it's a really controlled environment, you can culture foods that are safe for SIBO.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, especially if you know what the bacteria are. Like, I don't really care if it's called SIBO, but I do care which bacteria are involved.
Right.
Yeah, because then we know what to do to bring balance. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I want to go to the next slide. I think I showed the thing they do with the resistance. So this next page just gives another idea of what the doctor's data test shows. So it also measured the things like the fat and the vegetable fibers in the stool sample. And here we're looking at the page that says acetate and propionate and butyrate. So these are all short chain fatty acids that are made by bacteria that are fed by bifidum. So we take the bifidum, and then those bacteria that are not for sale are invited by bifidum to hang out, and then they create short-chain fatty acids, which can be beneficial for healing the gut, and we can also use for energy. That being said, nothing is entirely good nor evil. Some of these, like the propionate, have been associated with autistic-like symptoms. Mm-hmm. So, it's just everything in balance. But this guy is a bit low on some of these, and this is a person who is low on bifidum, so it made sense to me to see this.
Got it. Yeah, and you see the butyrate, at least. I don't know if any of the others can be taken in supplement form, but some people take butyrate, and it actually does help with the healing of the lining of the gut, so that can be taken as a supplement, and there's certain foods that contain it as well. But low short-chain fatty acids is a risk factor for leaky gut and other kinds of imbalances in the gut. And it's mostly the large intestine, but it's really important for it. They feed. They're like the nutrition that the gut lining loves. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So I guess on the next slide, we have our resistance panel. Yeah. So super cool. I'm sure many of you have seen this. They test the bacteria in my client, and they tell us which, natural herbs and natural kind of sources and antibiotics they are resistant or susceptible to. And so the ones in the green, in the bar graph, the bacteria are more susceptible to. And so they tested the Klebsiella. This particular person, I would be especially careful with our plan of action, because with the Klebsiella, the staph, the strep, and the E. coli, they can pass resistance on to each other. They don't just pass it to the next generation. They pass it to their friends. They pass it to different species. They pass it over. And these are four very commonly resistant bacteria. So it doesn't really matter for our purposes if the strep is resistant to antibiotics, if we're using herbs or other things, but we do need to know that the strep and the staph can easily become resistant to whatever we're using. So, yeah.
So So what you're saying here is you're looking at this and saying, because it says they're resistant to some of the most common things that we use in antimicrobial gut formulas, berberine, black walnut, oregano, and uva ursi, well, those first three are the most common ones, mm-hmm. that we want to make sure not to give them, if even if they show up okay for some other bacteria that they have. Is that what I'm hearing you say? Because
what I'm saying is no matter what I give this person, I'm going to make sure that I don't give it for longer than 5 days per herb each thing, and that in between, it doesn't see that herb again for at least 2 weeks. Hmm. So let's say I gave this person caprylic acid, or they decided themselves that they wanted to buy caprylic acid because we're not treating anything, and they would take it for 5 days, and then they would take some other herbs, and then they would come back to the caprylic acid no sooner than 2 weeks later.
Okay. That's good to know that it's 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Practical question here. When we're looking mm-hmm. at the Klebsiella, there's caprylic acid and grapefruit seed extracts. There's only two of them. So so would you be just giving them, say we choose caprylic acid, and then wait 5 days and then wait 2 weeks and then do the grapefruit seed extract? The caprylic acid and then the grapefruit seed extract, but you're still going to have a gap time in between because there's not enough to fill that 2 weeks.
Yeah, so I would just use another herb that's not tested on here, and I would ask the person what they eat on a regular basis. This person I spoke to 3 or 4 days ago, and I asked what kind of spices he likes to use, and he loves his Italian seasoning. So he's got this thing with oregano and thyme and marjoram, and sounds really delicious, but that's going to help me to know which things not to give him.
Got it. And that's why maybe the oregano is resistant in him.
Right. Okay. And again, these bacteria are totally notorious for that. So I would be looking at my herb chart that I have, and I would be picking something really rare in his life.
Mm. So he probably doesn't have a resistance to it because he hasn't been exposed to it.
Right. Yeah, okay. I said, have you tried French tarragon? And he's like, what's tarragon? I'm like, great.
It's very practical. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great.
It was awesome. And this whole time we were just talking about his dinner, you know, so it was a very light conversation, but gave me a really good bunch of clues as to which herbs would work well for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you have a list of those, or is that something you're going to do when you do your full practitioner training? Mm-hmm. Is that something you just need to start looking up?
I mean, I do have like a bullet point list, but my preference is to do it in a practitioner training just because there's
you
a lot
to be
with
able
herbs.
To explain it.
Yeah, I really want to be able to explain it. I don't want to just hand a list of herbs to people and then
It totally makes sense. No, that totally makes sense. Now, of these, I remember having a conversation with you where you said, well, silver doesn't work here, so it wouldn't matter. But like silver, they usually don't get resistant to, so you could continue to do that?
Yeah, you could continue to do the silver. You could continue to do stuff like, I don't know, ozonated water or like kind of non-herb things. It's more the plant matter, the essential oils, the antibiotics that they would become resistant to.
Okay. Yeah. And does the 5 day, 2 week rule also go for antibiotics? That I could see that being a really challenge to try to explain that to a doctor who wants to give somebody a 10-day course or a 20-day course.
Yeah. So if one of you would like to try to explain that to a doctor, that would be fantastic. You know, but it's really sad if we just add to the pile of things that they're resistant to. It just makes it more difficult.
It makes it harder to get rid of.
And I got to say with this Klebsiella, even though we're not talking about them specifically here, I see a lot of people who have been to the hospital, got pneumonia, took antibiotics, and now they have a systemic Klebsiella infection. You know, it's nobody's fault. It's just really, really common. I see it all the time, like once a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it ends up being really chronic, and
they
can migrate around in the body, and so it's a big deal.
It is a big deal.
To be responsible with the herbs.
And I want to just reiterate that this is my favorite test because of what you just said, this page, because you get this for every bacteria that's out of balance. Now, you won't get it for the E. coli, even though you want to treat an E. coli. And I guess you could cheat and you can find somebody who had an E. coli kind of showing up way out of range. and use that, but you don't really have that sensitivity thing, so you have to use more general approach. But with this, anything that's out of balance, they're going to give you this chart. So
my assumption with bacteria like these, because they can pass resistance to other species, not just other strains, I'm going to have to, with this test, make a flying assumption that if one of them is resistant to oregano, chances are they've been living in colony. They're all perhaps resistant to oregano.
That would be the safest assumption.
Yeah.
Great. And just to note, these are just the limit to what the test shows. And so there are other antimicrobial herbs, like Steph mentioned, tarragon and things like that, that can be helpful, but they just don't test them because they're not common ones. So there are other things that would help.
Totally.
That's great. All right.
Yeah. So what to do? So if it is, you know, SIBO situation, and sometimes even if it's not, the FODMAP diet can give people relief for a short time. And that's a topic for a total other discussion. But so that's an option.
Yep.
E. coli specific herbs. And so these are some herbs that specifically there have been studies on, good studies, that have shown that basil, like sweet basil in the garden, berberine, tarragon, bay laurel, lemongrass, sage, and thyme have been effective against E. coli. And so there's something to try. I mean, it is a bit of trial and error. And as you know, there are hundreds of different strains of E. coli, but I would start with the things that have been researched and are pretty benign.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty benign. French tarragon, basil, sage.
Yeah. They're pretty. They're things we mostly have in our I try to call my spice rack my medicine cabinet. Isn't that weird? That's stuff that most of us have in our spice rack, which is also your medicine cabinet, by the way. Yes. And that's good, because then you do the approach you said, is you do 5 days, you stop it, you do another one for 5 days, you stop it, and then you don't repeat it, so that you're not getting anything more than 2 weeks apart, less than 2 weeks apart. Yep.
Totally. For the fresh herbs, I think you would have to take gross amounts to get to the therapeutic amounts that were studied. But, I mean, if you are taking capsules, basil is one of the more, you know, and sage and lemongrass are more safe than a lot of things you could try. There are a lot of different options. I just put the safest ones in here, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get back to what you said about the fresh. So, I mean, sometimes you can make, like with basil, you can make a pesto, right? So you can use a ton of basil. So would it be a bunch or two, and then make a pesto out of it and blend it up with some nuts or seeds? Or
I'd have to do the math, but my guess is probably something like a couple bunches.
And then you eat it across a day.
Yeah, I mean, so you could do a smoothie and a pesto dip or something like that, and just eat it across the day.
So you could, if you're willing to do a lot of consumption. Yeah. And then what about the dried, the stuff that comes in the spice rack? Is that okay? Is it not as active?
Yeah. So if I were to do that, I would try to get the freshest thing possible. The freshest thing possible, or get something that is like a basil that's being sold as an antimicrobial, or, you know, something that is guaranteed to have some freshness to it. Yeah. You could cap it yourself, of course.
Okay. So getting, say, like Mountain Rose Herbs, which is a very reputable herb company, you can get like the pound of it and then just either encapsulate it or figure out a way to use a lot of it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then the quote-unquote dosages are going to depend on the person. The other good thing about these herbs is, if they're not the ones that you select, like let's say you select four completely different herbs, these are great herbs that taste good that people can incorporate into their meals.
Mm.
So why not have thyme plus, you know, berberine or whatever, you know? Yeah.
Good.
So some probiotics, well, all probiotics produce antibiotics against certain other bacteria. Most bacteria do that, just to kind of define their space. But there are some that have been studied to fight really well against E. coli. So we've got Lactobacillus rhamnosus and Lactobacillus bulgaricus. Back to the D-lactic acid thing, Lactobacillus bulgaricus does produce D-lactic acid. You might Google it, and some people have posted some silly things that say that they don't, but they do. I promise. And Lactobacillus rhamnosus does not. And so that would be my first choice for a probiotic in this situation. So, yeah, then there are, of course, all these other approaches and, yeah, things that I'm less familiar with. But I do want to mention Floraphage. Floraphage is a product from a company called Arthur Andrew. And I kind of Googled probiotics every once in a while, and I found this thing, and it said it was a probiotic multiplier. And I was like, what's this? And their marketing was really vague. So I phoned the company, and I talked to them, and they said that they had created a phage, which is basically a virus that attacks E. coli. But then when they went to market it, they were not allowed to say that.
Oh.
So this is cool. So they've created a virus that basically breaks open the protective cell wall of E. coli. And they're selling it in this product with this really vague, cheesy marketing, and it's called Floraphage. And I just thought that was so cool.
So they got around the FDA regulation but not really making it obvious to people what the thing is. So
yeah, except okay. Nobody has any idea what this product
nobody
does.
Nobody has any idea what it is. It sounds cool, though. I mean, the next time I get somebody with an E. coli on their chest, I'm going to consider it for sure.
Yeah, I would consider it along with the herbs.
Along with the herbs.
But yeah. But yeah, I think we should buy this because nobody else is going to because nobody else knows what it is.
Except the people that call the company.
Yeah, anyway, I'm excited about that one. And I've tried it myself and I'm pretty darn sensitive, so I didn't have any problem with it. So.
Right. And the ozonated water, how does that, just drink ozonated water or sometimes drink ozonated water? How does that work?
Yeah, so that would be like the ozonated water machine that basically puts O3 in water. It's not my first choice because I don't think it kills the yeast, but it really does kill Blastocystis hominis. And I really need to find another word other than kill. It balances Blastocystis hominis, and it can also work with the E. coli as well. So it just depends what the whole picture of the person is. And sometimes people don't want to go to the doctor. They don't want to take a rotating protocol of herbs, and they don't want to put things in their Amazon shopping cart, and they just want to do one thing, then this is an option. So ozonated water is an option. Yeah.
Great to know.
Yeah. So let's go Enterobacter. So Enterobacter is very closely related to E. coli. They're very similar. And they also have a similar propensity to develop resistance to things. Like E. coli, they eat glucose and lactose. They eat the pretty simple sugars, and they produce D-lactic acid. One thing that sets the Enterobacter apart is that they produce histamine. They can produce a lot of histamine. And so, you know, depending on your client, this might not be the best thing for them, particularly if they have not enough bifidum bacteria or if they have any of the SNPs where they don't make enough DAO, which is the enzyme that breaks down the histamine. And that is the same enzyme that the bifidum infantis and bifidum adolescentes make. So yeah, it's just important if somebody's having a histamine situation, then I will be looking for this bacteria along with a few others that we'll talk about in a bit.
Okay, did you just say that the bifidus infantis and what was the other one make the DAO?
Yeah, they do. So bifidum bifidus adolescentes. It's like adolescent with an IS.
Okay, so baby and teenager bifidus.
Baby and teenager. Yes,
that way.
That's exactly how I remember it.
Baby and teenager. And the DAO, you know, just so you know, DAO is sold on the market, but they're all not
supplements. They're not clean.
That I feel good. They're not clean at all, even the ones from the clean companies. So they're hard. They all have like talc in them or shellac or some kind of stuff. I think they're all made by the same company and other companies that private label them. But I haven't found a single one. So, you know, a lot of people want to take it, but it's like, you know, I don't like having people take something to heal one area when it might hurt another area. So better would be the infantis and the adolescents, the teenager and the baby bifidus.
Exactly.
So that you can get your body to make more of it.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there are other things that break down histamine, like quercetin.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of other things to do, and I think it's a topic for another conversation. The Enterobacter and the Citrobacter. Citrobacter is a type of Enterobacter, basically. Citrobacter also produces a lot of histamine and has been associated with ulcerative colitis. So if someone's coming to me and they have ulcerative colitis, I'm looking for Enterobacter or Citrobacter. Those are one of the first bacteria that I'm looking for. And they can often slip through the cracks. So someone might notice an infection with Klebsiella or something like that, but then something underlying with the Enterobacter or the Citrobacter might have been going on for a long time. And so I like to make sure that I'm really thorough and check for that. That's it for the Enterobacter, I think. But yeah, definitely look for them if you've got IBS or colitis. So Laura says, which two bacteria? So Enterobacter and Citrobacter. It's on the slides, so hopefully you guys can download those.
Yeah.
See, so again, if you're going to do FODMAPs, short time, and how to get off of those is another topic. Mm-hmm. Bifidum to balance out the histamines. Or direct DAO supplementation. If anybody finds a good, clean DAO, like none of this fillers or anything in it, please do let me know. Would be wonderful.
I looked exhaustively one day. Oh. I mean, I spent an hour and I looked at every product I could find and I couldn't find anything clean.
Yeah, me too. And I called people and it's not happening. So, but yeah, we want to be the first to know, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so rotating with these guys is important too, with the Enterobacter.
Okay.
Aha! Yeast overgrowth. So I know they're not a bacteria, but I do think that they're really important and they can live in concert with a bacteria, you know, and I kind of think Candida is a little overdiagnosed sometimes, especially when these other bacteria, the E. coli and the Enterobacter, are kind of playing counterpoint and feeding them the whole time. So I like to deal with the bacteria first because then we're cutting off the food supply for the Candida. That being said, if we never address the Candida, it is my opinion that we can't really come back to a real state of homeodynamics or homeostasis, whatever your preference. So the Candida is really important, like it or not. So there could be too many bacteria, as we talked about feeding the yeast. There could be too much sugar, too many cupcakes, not enough, you know, movement of the intestinal tract, not enough stomach acid, just not enough, like, digestive chi or digestive fire, if you will. Trace mineral deficiencies. I do want to talk about that for a minute because this is an area that I feel is sorely missed with Candida. So certain trace minerals, for lack of a better word, are anti-Candida. Like Candida does not like boron, lithium, and germanium. And Candida does not like sulfur. So sulfur can help the gut lining to be less habitable by Candida, so they won't be able to take hold as much as they would without the sulfur being present. Some dietary sources of sulfur, of course, the sulfurated amino acids are onions and garlic, and a lot of people can't actually tolerate those. So I think sometimes you're going to end up in a situation with a client that, you know, needs sulfur but is afraid of sulfur.
Yeah.
But I think sulfur is very important. It's also important for blood sugar metabolism. And if we're not eating sugar, there will be someone else who moves in to eat the sugar for us. So I think those trace minerals are really very important.
Yeah. And with the sulfur, there were some other sources of sulfur in supplemental form would be something like NAC, N-acetylcysteine, methyl sulfate, and any of, like you said, methionine and some of the other sulfur
methionine.
It might be possible that somebody does okay on those supplements versus the onion garlic, because maybe there's some other things in there, but some people do get gassy and bloated on onions and garlic. The other things that are reasonable sources of sulfur are your cruciferous vegetables.
Totally. It does happen to me that I get the person who's like, I can't eat broccoli and I can't eat onions and I can't eat garlic. And so we have to find another source of sulfur if we're really, you know, diving into this Candida thing. But yeah, the methionine is good. The NAC is good. I love to get it from food though.
Yeah.
And I mean, for me, I feel like a lot of the onion and garlic problems are bacterial problems more so than sulfur problems.
How so?
And so if we're dealing with the bacteria first, if we can get the bacteria in balance in the small intestine, then they might be able to eat onions and garlic and not have the bloating.
You think that the garlic and onions, maybe the sulfur may be feeding the bad bacteria? Is that what you're thinking?
Oh, no, because they're high FODMAP foods.
Okay.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, sometimes, but this is different for every single person, but I think sometimes people say they can't tolerate onions and garlic, but then they can get into a place where they can then tolerate them again.
Okay. But that would be a situation where the sulfur might be okay if it's a FODMAP sensitivity,
right?
And for those of you who don't know yet what FODMAPs are, that's also in there's a whole module we just released called SIBO, FODMAPs and SCD diets, specific carbohydrates. So we go into a lot of that there. Yeah.
Okay, good. So we'll skip that for now. And I think a lot of people here are totally in the know about the FODMAP too.
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. So I go into it in a lot of detail. Maybe it's repetitious for some, but I think it's good to just know. So so that way we don't have to go define terms and explain what FODMAPs are. You can
get
that from that module.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not always Candida. So we know about Candida albicans, and there are many other kinds of Candida. And then there are many other kinds of yeasts, the single-celled yeasts. And so it's not always Candida. A lot of the testing that we can do isn't super great at finding Candida, and they're not even testing for any of the other yeasts. So even if tests come back negative, it doesn't mean that there's not a yeast present.
Yeah. Got it. Now, a lot of the tests are testing for weird. I've seen some weird Candidas come back, some of them I hadn't heard of before recently on a doctor's data. But talk a little bit about the brewer's yeast, because people take nutritional yeast. Is that the same? Does it have the same issues? If somebody's sensitive to Candida, will they also necessarily be sensitive to brewer's yeast or nutritional yeast? So, I'd love to hear your perspective.
Yeah, so that's an immune system thing, right, rather than the yeast itself. I will tell you a story about the brewer's yeast. I decided, you know, not to eat meat and dairy anymore. I think I was 13. I came home. I'm like, I'm not going to do this. My mom did some research and decided that I needed B12. She read about nutritional yeast. She came home with 5-star brewer's yeast. I put it on my sandwiches for a week, and boy, oh boy, did I ever get a systemic yeast infection, which of course didn't show up on any naturopathic tests that we took. But I knew darn well that I had a yeast infection, and I knew that that was a live yeast that I'd been eating all week. So I don't think I'm the only one. You know, and there are a lot of yeasts in the world. I do want to talk about kombucha. Kombucha has Candida in it.
Ooh.
Full stop.
That's bad news.
Yeah, it also feeds Candida because those yeasts like to eat sugars that have been pre-fermented. So in a case like having a rash after drinking kombucha or having an allergic reaction to kombucha, that is Candida. That's just your body not liking Candida. But the levels of Candida in the SCOBY itself and in the drink itself can vary. But unless you're going to take your kombucha to a lab, and this is just my personal opinion, I would not be drinking that stuff.
Mm.
I do still use it to make, I'll make a quote-unquote medicinal kind of thing with it. Like I'll let it go really, really far, like a vinegar, and then I'll put stuff in it like milk thistle or rose hips or something, and, you know, take a shot before my meal. But that's as far as I would go with the kombucha. So some pretty good studies have found that it does actually contain Candida.
Okay. And just because a lot of people are doing Kavita as a probiotic beverage, that's different, right? Because that's coconut.
Yep. Totally different because of the yeasts that are in there. So for any of those kind of beverages, there will be yeasts and bacteria. And so, like, functionally, the yeast that's in the Kavita is different because it's Saccharomyces boulardii.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, if the immune system has just had enough of yeast and is on red alert, you know, it just depends on your client, how they react to other yeasts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's good to hear because Saccharomyces boulardii has always been like, you give people that when they have these other overgrowths. And I've had people come back with way over the top high Saccharomyces boulardii. And the other thing about it is where you might be getting it and you don't realize is a lot of the food source vitamins are grown on Saccharomyces boulardii. So like mega foods or any of the ones that say they're food grown, they're usually grown on the Saccharomyces. So if somebody says, oh, I take that vitamin and I feel really awful or I get a rash or I get diarrhea or whatever, then they may be sensitive. So if somebody shows up in their stool tests as sensitive to the Saccharomyces and overgrowth of it, then you may want to cut back for a while on those
on the Kavita.
The vitamins and the Kavita. Yep.
Oh, that's awesome about the vitamins. I didn't know that. That's great. I mean, well, it's not great, but it's good information.
It's good to know. Yeah.
It's not great.
Right. No, it's not a lot of things that are not great, but it's good to know.
Yeah. If a person has a yeast overgrowth and they also have, you know, symptoms of a leaky gut or they have any other kind of systemic autoimmunity, I'm very hesitant to give them beneficial yeast, including Saccharomyces boulardii. Okay. I prefer to work a little bit on the gut integrity first before, and they do need some of these yeasts, you know, they quote, need them, but they do need them. So it is important to add them at a certain point, but adding them too soon, you know, you might risk a little bit of like a reaction in the person. And like, I like to treat people gently. It depends again on your client. But yeah, if there's anything that we're giving people that is causing inflammation, in the end, it's going to be counterproductive to healing the gut.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so anaerobic or aerobic. So they're fine if you have ozonated water. They can survive. So good to know. They can eat straight sugar or they can eat fermented sugars. They prefer the pre-fermented sugars from bacteria. They're a big producer of histamine, again. So if someone has a combination of Enterobacter and Candida and H. pylori, which we'll talk about later, the other big histamine producer, they might be experiencing histamine symptoms, and then these would be the things to look for. And that would be like rashes or dizziness after eating certain foods, and it's another conversation. Yeah. So Candida can grow almost anywhere in the body, and so you'll also see people, of course, who have toe fungus and, you know, skin rashes, and it'll give you some clues because a lot of the tests won't show up.
Yeah. So would you say that for people who have the jock itch or the fungal infections on their feet or ringworm, would you suspect that they have it in their gut, or would you just assume that they do because they have it in other parts of their body?
So it depends on their budget. If they're made of cash, I send them for the oat test.
Okay.
But, you know, if they're okay with going through a yeast protocol and avoiding some of those sugars, which is not a bad idea anyway.
Not a bad idea anyway, right?
Yeah, I do assume it. I assume it in my imagination, but I do like to have some testing just in case the person wants that. And I have the oat. Yeah.
Okay. So we would... probably, it's most likely if they have a fungal infection somewhere else on their body that they probably have some overgrowth in their gut.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it couldn't hurt to. And a lot of times you will, I've seen this happen, where you treat the gut and the jock itch goes away or the toenail fungus goes away. You know, and there's things you can do directly to those things to make them go away, but you're not addressing the root cause. So you can do tea tree oil and all kinds of stuff. You can do the over-the-counter fungal antifungals. You can do the really strong liver killer antifungal.
The Diflucan.
Diflucan. But a lot of times all you need to do is get the gut going. You know.
Yeah. Totally.
Very good.
Yeah, there's the pretty Candida. These ones are in there. They're kind of spreading. These are their like fungal form.
From micellars. Yeah.
All right.
And mention biofilm. So just like tell people, biofilm is covered in great detail in the dysbiosis module in the program. Mm. So I go into that, but if you want to just touch on that a little bit, that would be great.
Yeah, you did go into that quite a bit. And just for anybody who's kind of wanting to picture a biofilm, they're not necessarily bad. It's what happens when bacteria and yeasts are living together. And some bacteria and yeast can produce them on their own as well. It's basically the SCOBY from kombucha. You know, like they create a film. And you will have one in your nose and in your ears and, you know, in your vagina and in your gut. And that's just, sorry if you don't have a vagina, that's just what it is.
Yeah, I get it.
So, yeah, and you can break down the biofilm to get, to have access to the yeast if you're trying to bring them into balance. I've also seen people overdo the biofilm breakdown. And since you talk a lot about biofilm in the module, maybe I'll just talk for a second about what happens when we take too much serrapeptase, and that can break down the mucosal lining of our small intestine. So a client might feel pain, and they might be on a yeast protocol, and you might be wondering why. And if they're feeling pain, it could be too much serrapeptase.
Okay.
That being said,
that's
Yeah, it's totally good to know. So I see it happen to people, you know, sometimes, not all the time, not even regularly, but it does happen. I did a water fast for 10 days and I took 5 serrapeptase 5 times a day. Didn't happen to me.
Oh, very good.
I love to experiment on myself. Just, you know,
Take it to the extreme. So it might be someone who already has a thinned mucosal lining or already has leaky gut, who may have a history of gluten intolerance and celiac and that sort of thing. And there are things that thin the mucosal lining, which we talk about in the other modules, but, you know, things like alcohol and caffeine will actually thin that mucosal lining. Yeah. Deficiencies of vitamin B1 and vitamin A thin that mucosal lining. So you just, it's really important to take a good history with people and really ask the right questions to make sure that the things you're giving them to heal aren't going to cause them to have a problem.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
And now somebody asked about megafoods, and I said, so it's S. cerevisiae that the megafoods are grown on. So I'm not sure. I have to look that one up to see.
It is another yeast. So the same thing with
another Saccharomyces. So you still have to be careful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so I think the next slide is the oat pest. Oh, no, this is a really cute baby tongue.
This is a cute baby tongue.
Yeah, that's yeast. There we go.
Okay, that's what it looks like. And I remember, you know, my son, when he was first born, we adopted him, and we got him at about 3 weeks old. And they hand me this baby, and I looked at him, and I'm like, oh, my God, he's got thrush.
Oh no.
His tongue looked like that. It took me a while to get him under control. Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a common baby thing. You'll hear thrush and then they put them on Nystatin. And that was what they did. They pat him on Nystatin. And I immediately took the Nystatin and threw it in the trash and said, we're not going to use this. We're going to get this under control naturally.
Awesome. That's
he survived. Awesome. He's almost 18 now. So.
Yeah, that's awesome. So an overgrowth of yeast has been associated with so many things that I just can't even write them on this slide. Pretty much everything has been attributed to yeasts and some over attributed to yeast, but fibromyalgia, headaches, fatigue, acne, dry skin, thyroid conditions, gluten cross-reactivity. I think these are the very valid situations that can happen with an overgrowth of yeast.
Yeah. You list a lot more of them in the module, but, you know, things like brain fog and fatigue. You already mentioned fatigue.
Totally.
But there's so many things, and mental stress, depression. I mean, so many things can be associated with it. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, that's why I like the oat test. Where's my slide?
You mentioned it at the bottom of this, so it'll be after this.
All right. Yeah, so here are some kinds of tests that, like, your client may have already tried or may have done when they come to see you. You know, people do this thing where this is so crude, but they spit in a cup and then they like look to see if the spit, you know, makes these stringy things. That's a really fun test. It's not actually a candida test. It'll show if you have, you know, the right kind of mucus that might have candida in it, kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, I don't really use that one very much, but I know that people do it a lot. And then there's the bacterial test. I do see yeast come back on the doctor's data and the BioHealth 401 as well. I don't usually run those specifically if I feel that a person is likely to have a yeast overgrowth. I would prefer to do the oat. However, if they have a bacterial overgrowth, there's quite often a yeast component, so I'm looking for that. And that's another reason why I like the Doctor's Data test. So the blood test, some people go for live blood analysis, and then the stool testing that we just talked about and some other things.
Okay. And some people do a breast test. I've never really done a breast test for yeast, but I've heard of some people doing that.
Oh. Yeah, I haven't done that either.
There we are. We have the oat test. I just got one of these back today. I'm going to have to present it right after this call.
So, there's a lot of information here. That's why I like this test. But it will show the byproducts of bacteria and yeasts. And it'll show some of the more harmful ones, like the quinolinic acid that might have an effect on the brain, or the arabinose, or like you can kind of tell if a person even has a D-lactic acid overgrowth.
How would you tell that?
Test. I need to have a look. I don't think it's on this page.
So the arabinose is the one that I think about with yeast.
Yeah.
And what's interesting too, and again, you have to be careful when you get these tests back. The one I got back was not quite 90. It was a little less than that, but it was over the range and it didn't get flagged. And I'm like, but it should be, right? I mean, it's likely that that person has an overgrowth if they're out of the average range.
Totally. Totally. Yeah. And we don't even really want to be on the, you know, higher, the low end of the, I mean, low would be fine for candida.
Yeah.
We don't really want to be in the top 20% of people who have yeast that go for the oat test.
Right.
People who have yeast that go for the oat test.
Right. Exactly. Let's see. This was 26. Well, my range is a little different on this one, but it was, they said that less than 29, but it was still outside this range. It was still outside the little bar range.
Yeah.
So yours doesn't show the full bar because yours is so high there. It's real clear. But mine shows more of a elongated bar like these others. And it shows that, you know, it's outside that mean. It's way up at 26. So I would like to see it more towards the middle or the low end.
Yeah, this is a nice super clear one with the
that was really clear. But this one didn't get flagged. It didn't get flagged, which I thought was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so just taking a look at the balance again, and not just whether things are in the red or the black, I think is really important.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. So I have on my notes here, mention kombucha. We did it.
We already did.
But yeah, so again, going back to the basics is just really important for candida. I don't really tend to look at it, and this is, again, another personal philosophy, in terms of killing off all the candida. I'm not entirely sure if that's possible. But we definitely want to keep them from deciding that now is the time to proliferate.
Mm.
You know, and a lot of the things that we can do that can send them the signal that now is the time, you know, is processed foods and simple sugars, and like really having a really good look at whether your client is eating a muffin every afternoon, or, and then other yeasts that are causing reactions, which we kind of talked about, which doesn't directly feed candida. It just can contribute to inflammation in the body, which then contributes to the environment where candida are more comfortable living.
Yeah.
So everything is connected. Yeah, and if the histamine is a problem, you could consider direct DAO supplementation if you can find a really good one, or the bifidum.
Right.
Yeah. Biofilm disruptors, there are many, and I know that Dr. Rita Marie covers this in the microbial module, and so I'm not going to cover that super much. There are a lot of, I will say, new products that are supposedly these really new fancy things, and I do get messages about them every day. They're all serrapeptase. So, yeah, just to be really cognizant of marketing and just find the cleanest proleolytic enzymes that you can find and stick with them until something better comes along. Yeah,
absolutely.
And of course there's, you know, the orange oil and the rosemary and, yeah, just whatever your client is comfortable with.
Okay. And then what do you think about the things like the Pau d'Arco tea and some of the other antifungal herbs that are out there? I mean, I know coconut oil can be very helpful too, because there's some antifungal properties of lauric acid and such.
Yeah, so I love that. I love Pau d'Arco tea. It is a high FODMAP. And FODMAP, again, is the foods that can feed bacterial overgrowth, particularly in the small intestine.
Now, would you say that if somebody does not bloat up, if somebody who's got the overgrowth and they drink that particular tea or any of the things that are considered FODMAP but also have therapeutic value, like slippery elm and the other stuff, that they could use the symptoms as a sign whether they tolerate it or not? Like if they take it and they don't blow up. So what I usually have people do is like go a couple of weeks on this low FODMAP diet and be real strict about it for a couple of weeks and then start looking at what are the most therapeutic health promoting foods that you're leaving out, and then start introducing them one at a time. Do it for a few days. Make sure you don't blow up with it. If you don't blow up, you know, you add it back in. Because these diets, some people are following FODMAP diets and these SCD diets forever. And it's like, holy cow, you can't do that. It's too restrictive.
It's ridiculous, Oops, I just said it was ridiculous. But you nailed it. That's exactly it. And the Pau d'Arco tea is one that I would consider reintroducing. If it's not causing gas and bloating, fine.
Yeah.
Another one is marshmallow root. This is a bit of a digression, but it's also antibacterial. I mean, it's antibacterial and it's also a FODMAP, you know, and it just depends on the client. Like it depends on if they're working on rebuilding their intestinal mucosa and you're looking for a demulcent, you know, marshmallow is a really good choice of a FODMAP to add back in because it has antibacterial properties as well.
So we always have to look at, and I teach this to my clients all the time, they want to take something that because they read about it being good for one thing, but then it can hurt another thing. So there's always that balance. Like one of my clients wants to eat prunes because she wants to eat the 8 or 9 prunes a day that are good for bone health. But she has had diabetes and we've gotten her into control and she still has some blood sugar issues. You can't do 9 prunes a day if you got diabetes. I think it's, you know, going to throw off the blood sugar. So you always have to look at the trade-offs. Everything has trade-offs. You look at the good, you look at the bad. If the good outweighs the bad and you're not getting symptoms from it, then go for it.
Yeah. Bingo.
Yeah.
Totally agree. Yeah. So And then again, the trace minerals. Okay, so parasite overgrowth. I'm not sure if either of these organisms that we're about to talk about are actually parasites, but I do like to think of them in a separate category from the other bacteria because they're more motile, so they can move around and they can more directly affect the function of some of our digestive organs. I think about these particular creatures in a different category. Here are some risk factors, I guess, for parasite introduction. So low levels of stomach acid, low motility of any part of the digestive system, exposure, yeasts, and other bacterial co-infections. So if a person does have any of these bacterial infections or kind of setting up D-lactic acid area in the body, then it's a really prime place for parasites to move into. And trace mineral and vitamin deficiencies, which we sort of talked about a little bit before, can kind of set a person up for a parasite overgrowth. You know, and then there's just exposure. And so taking a really good history and finding out where your client has been. I know that when I lived in China, I picked up some very interesting, very interesting intestinal things. You know, and I do think here, the ones that I've chosen to talk about are ones that I see quite frequently. And I think are very important and with people who haven't been anywhere.
Yeah.
So, ta-da! H. pylori, which I know is a bacteria, but it's a spirochete, so it's got a little bit of, you know, different action. And blastocystis hominis. Dun-dun-dun! And so, you know, they keep changing what this is. You know, first it was like some kind of yeast, and then they decided it was an amoeba, and now they've put it in this category of, like, algae type organism.
Wow.
They keep changing their mind, and like I don't really care what it is. It can be, it's so weird. It can be an amoeba at a certain stage of its life cycle. So that's how I like to think about it. Yeah, I don't think the debate is over on that one.
No, so I don't think so.
Yeah, seriously. But yeah, so it can live in its cyst form, which is, you know, when it's part of its life cycle, which we're going to have a look at in a bit. Yeah, or it can be like an amoeba, And so you'll see that better on the next slide. And it can be associated with inflammation of the digestive lining. It has an affinity for the small intestine and for living around the gallbladder ducts. So if there's a client that's having trouble digesting fats and it's been, you know, quite chronic, and especially for people who are, I find, losing a lot of weight or, you know, they have a lot of unexplained symptoms, I like to send them for the 401, the biohealth test for this one. That being said, it misses it sometimes.
Mm.
So it's just the one that I find is the most reliable, but it doesn't catch it every time. Yeah. And so, you know, they can go dormant and they can live in a bunch of different forms and they can interfere with our bile, which then in turn interferes with the environment in the small intestine, which is no good.
Not good at all.
No.
Not good at all. And it's interesting because, like, when we have somebody who's having trouble with the fat digestion or, you know, gallbladder spasms or some things along those lines, we're not really thinking, is there a blastocystis hominis overgrowth, right? Mm. So it's really good to keep that in mind.
Right. Yeah. Right. Like, for example, if we're thinking, ooh, let's do a liver cleanse, you know, it's going to be really harder for the body to purge things through the gallbladder if there's, like, you know, little buggers running interference.
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
So
good to look at.
Much to know.
Yeah.
All right.
I hope this is helpful.
It's very helpful. Who thinks it's helpful? Let's get some feedback. Who thinks
this is
helpful?
Am I putting you to sleep? Are you awake?
No, I'm totally fascinated.
Okay, good.
I haven't delved this deeply into the bacterial stuff, so I love it.
Cool. All right. So yeah, I want to go to the next. I drew a fun infographic for you.
Okay. So you want to skip this one? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
We already talked about. Okay.
Yeah,
and I'm just going to say before we do your beautiful infographic that Maura just texted me a picture of, I think what she found is a clean DAO supplement. And I will read you the ingredients. It's called Histame, H-I-S-T-A-M-E.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, let's see, done. And then I'll go to the next one. I'm going to look at the back. She texted me the front and the back.
Awesome.
And it says it's got vitamin C, calcium carbonate, which isn't the best form of calcium, but I can live with it, DAO, diamine oxidase enzyme. It is not vegetarian, so anybody that's vegetarian will want to avoid it. It's porcine kidney protein concentrated pellets. And then it's other ingredients, cellulose and water.
Well.
Okay, so it's Maryland Nutraceuticals, and it's HIST AME. HISTAME. And I will just say, can you clarify what ozonated water is? Kathleen in Boulder is asking us to make sure. Do you get it, or do you make it, or how do you do it?
Yeah, so I will just say, actually, ozonated water really, really helped me. I had a systemic infection and a bone infection and a sinus infection at one point, and I did some pretty crazy stuff with ozonated water. What I'm talking about specifically is a machine that you can buy that adds O3 to water. You know, when it's stinky, you have to put it outside. You don't want to be breathing O3, but it definitely kills bacteria. Some of the machines are more expensive than others. I know that you can get them on Amazon. The one that I used was the soda machine.
And then one last question from Kathleen again. Are coconut aminos okay with candida?
So my understanding is that there will be some wild yeasts in there. I think it should be okay, provided they're not having an immune reaction to it.
Okay.
Yeah. So I would use that, and I would use the Kavita. Unless it's like just a super, super sensitive person.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
So, yay, this is the blastocystis life cycle. And this is really fun because it's a ridiculous life cycle. So they come kind of like encapsulated in this kind of protective coating. So this would be like something that came in through your mouth kind of thing. This is your small intestine. You can see the little villi.
Did you draw this?
Yes, I spent an hour trying to download an app that would help me draw, and then I was like, wait a minute, I could just draw.
Just draw. It looks great.
Yes, it's tweetable. Okay, but so these little vacuoles come out of the cyst, which is like this protected thing, and so then they can reproduce by just dividing. They can reproduce, and they can live in that state for a while. Or they can encapsulate themselves, and then that can break open, and then they can reproduce for a while. So, like, I don't know why it's doing all these different things, but this is what it can do. So, or they can become an amoeba, which is that little blue guy there. And so those guys are more motile, which not super convenient for us, but there it is. And then those guys can reproduce just the way they are. Or they can go back to being these little vacuoles and encapsulate themselves and get pooped out and passed on to the next person.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's the fecal-oral route. So it's just, you know, for all these things, and H. pylori, which we're going to talk about in a minute, it's washing our hands before we prepare food. Like, it's just that stuff. You know, not being super fastidious about germs, but, you know, making sure that we're washing our hands before we prepare food. And, you know, we can't prevent everything, but this is how this particular guy is passed around.
Right. And yeah. Washing your hands after you change baby's diaper.
Good one.
Big one, right? Or not putting your hands to your mouth while you're changing baby's diaper.
Yeah.
And again, the other piece is fecal transplants, which we're not going to talk about much here, but the fecal transplants are becoming more popular, and a lot of people are doing them at home. And I would really recommend that you have somebody that you're going to, if you have somebody giving the fecal transplant material to someone else, that there's a stool test done to make sure that there's no buggers in there that you're going to pass on.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I would do more than one stool test. You know, and
you
I
mean like more than one sequentially, or more than one different brand at the same time to just
exactly. Like if it were me, like just off the top of my head, if I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to do this, I would get the 401H test if I was going to do this. I'm not suggesting that you do this, and I would get the doctor's data test.
Okay.
I wouldn't bother with the eubiome or anything. Like, those are fun, but I don't find them that clinically relevant at this point.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Because I have had people have good success with them, but and they didn't test. So it's like, you know, but apparently the donor was more healthy than the recipient, so it worked out.
Right. I don't know. I've had enough stuff go wrong, you know, that I, for myself, would test.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to play with my body anymore. I've decided.
Got
it. Yeah.
All right. Great graphic. Yeah. I love it.
So we don't really know, you know, and a lot of medical doctors and alternative, quote unquote, or holistic or whatever, a lot of people think blastocystis is not a problem. You know, and when I first started researching this guy, I was told from all sorts of different angles, naturopaths and, you know, everybody's saying, oh, it's not a problem. If the person's immune system is good, then it's not a problem. But I do find that when a person is kind of backed into a corner of dysbiosis or things being out of balance, like our goal is to restore balance, but like it or not, these organisms that are interfering, we need to deal with them. And, you know, we can argue about blastocystis and what it is, if it's an amoeba or if it matters. We can argue about if it matters or not. If a person is sitting in front of me and they have symptoms and I know that they have blastocystis, I am not going to move on until I know that we have dealt with the blastocystis.
Sounds great. And I'm just going to read back what Laura wrote. She said, wow, my stool test showed blastocystis hominis and an infectious disease doctor told me that doesn't cause any issues and it's normal to have that. Also had my gallbladder removed a few years ago. I wish I knew about it sooner. Great stuff.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that you're doing the SIBO diet and loving the FODMAPs right now. I would still address the blastocystis. I don't care what anybody says. I would still address it. If you've got symptoms and you have blastocystis, they're part of the imbalanced situation.
Right.
And we want to introduce a new paradigm to your digestive system. Yeah.
Absolutely. That makes sense. Yeah.
I think this is an area where, like, this is why I'm so excited that we're having this call and we're going to have more calls and whatever like this. And because I'm not that interested in blastocystis. I'm tired of blastocystis. I'm tired of the debate. But, like, one out of every four or five people at this point, maybe it's just a coincidence, you know, that I send for the 401H test comes back with the stinking blastocystis. And with so much, you know, misinformation or not understanding or confusion on this topic, like, people need to step up and, yeah, and learn how to deal with this parasite, if we want to call it that.
Whatever it is, it doesn't belong, right? It's out of balance. So I don't care what you call it. If you've got a guy in your backyard and you want to call him a predator or an intruder or an invader, a burglar, I don't care. I just want him out of my backyard.
Yeah, exactly. But we need more people kind of specializing in this kind of work, not just killing them, but like restoring balance to the organs. And this whole blastocystis thing is an area where I really see that there's a lot of research to be done in the future and a lot of, you know, specialization that could be possible. Yeah.
And the whole thing about balance, I'm just going to reiterate it. It's not about killing the bacteria. It's never about killing the bacteria. It's not about killing the bacteria in pneumonia, although you need to do that sometimes when people are at the life-threatening situation. But it's then, why did that bacteria get out of control? Let's restore balance so we don't have something else popping up somewhere else or the same thing coming back again.
Right. So some of the things that I have seen work for blastocystis, and again, this is just kind of a list of the things that I've seen work because I'm tired of this guy. Papaya seed extract, whether it's the powder or if you can find a good clean tincture. Pomegranate husks.
The husks meaning what, the white stuff inside of it or the outside? What do you mean by the husks?
I believe that it's the white stuff that they make the tincture out of.
Okay.
And so, yeah, that. The regular kind of parasite cleanses do work sometimes. I've found that they're not always awesome for the blastocystis. I've seen colloidal silver like 10 times a day work. I don't want to take colloidal silver 10 times a day, but some people have done that and it has worked. Again, the ozonated water does work for these guys, but might, you know, you have to be cognizant of the imbalance that it might also create. And then this drug, and it's a pharmaceutical, and I don't know how to pronounce it, nitazoxanide. But, you know, some studies have found it to be more than 90% effective.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's just like a multiple layered situation going on, and like if my client or your client is open to bridging, you know, the Western medical system and your assistance, it's something to consider. You know, something when I'm going to send them to the doctor and they're going to get something that's like 40% effective, I'm thinking, meh.
Yeah.
But if it's 90% effective and it's not expensive and, you know, if it's in the place of doing 10 different supplements and colloidal silver 10 times a day, I think this is the place where we might consider pharmaceuticals.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to be open-minded.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, H. pylori.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, so this one I think is my favorite. So I really love to look for H. pylori because they're in the stomach, kind of the first place that the food sits when it goes through our mouth and through our esophagus into our bodies, and the stomach really sets up the behavior of a lot of our other digestive organs. And if the H. pylori is interfering with the function of the stomach, it can kind of set up a cascading effect of not really awesome things. So the wrong pH or not enough motility or many things can happen. But the H. pylori can interfere with stomach acid production. You know, there's a bit of a misconception that H. pylori likes an acidic environment. What they do is they can survive an acidic environment. They actually like it to be less acidic. And so they'll kind of go out of their way to decrease the acidity in a person's stomach, which can further bring down their stomach acid production, which works for them, not so good for us absorbing our minerals and proteins and, you know, everything else. Ironically, they like to kind of move into a situation where a person might already have slightly low stomach acid. And a big percentage of the population has H. pylori, and they're not always a problem. But for people for whom they are a problem, it's sometimes people who have already got low stomach acid, and then the H. pylori then make it lower. And so I've seen a lot of literature saying that H. pylori has benefits and that H. pylori is actually good. And there's, I'm totally into this whole everything is really good paradigm. In this case, and in a couple other cases, I completely disagree. With the H. pylori, the sources that I've found that have said that H. pylori is beneficial, they're referencing the fact that it reduces GERD and gastric reflux. And they're saying, you know, H. pylori is good. It brings down heartburn. And we know from being in this program and from doing our research that heartburn quite often happens in situations where a person has too low stomach acid to begin with. So it's basically a person, you know, taking Pepto-Bismol or having H. pylori, kind of same result. And I wouldn't recommend either of those things. So yeah, I just think that's a really important. So when reading the research on these bacteria, especially because a lot of things are really new and we're going to be bombarded with marketing and articles, to really pay attention to the sources from which they come. Yeah, because it's one of those, oh, but I heard they were good. And your clients are probably going to say that at a certain point. And it's going to be important to explain to them the function of the stomach and where that researcher was coming from or that author was coming from when they wrote the book, so that you can really explain why we do, in fact, want to deal with H. pylori. And I do hear this from a lot of very qualified and wonderfully intelligent people telling me that H. pylori is not a problem and that we should just take hydrochloric acid supplements.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. And they are attributed to ulcers. They bore holes into the lining of the stomach and also the intestines. So they can be have been attributed to leaky gut. But the other thing is, when you're actually doing an H. pylori eradication protocol, it's important not to be doing the HCL. And the reason for that is, you want to explain that or should I?
Because they hide.
They hide. Thank you. They say, oh, acid, I'm going to hide because they prefer the low alkaline. And then if you're taking the substances that are going to eradicate them, those substances aren't doing any good because it's causing them to actually bore deeper into the lining of the stomach and the intestinal mucosa, which not only gets to hide and not make the treatment effective, but also it's damaging the mucosa.
Exactly.
So, yeah. And so even
the last thing we want
in stomach acid, you got to avoid having them take it. And I've seen people who've gotten worse when I put them on stomach acid and it didn't make sense. And then we did their, is it 401H? And then it came back that they had the H. pylori. And so we eradicated the H. pylori and then they could go back and get their stomach acid restored and everybody was happy.
And everyone lived happily ever after. But because the stomach acid is so important in restoring the balance in SIBO and blastocystis and motility and everything, like stomach acid is pivotal. And because that's one of the places where I like to start with people, I'm not going to just give people suggestions for HCL supplements or bitters if I'm not sure if they have an H. pylori situation going on.
So and I, what I would like make you suspect it? So that's something to ask for us to hear, because what would make you suspect that, yes, they do have it versus now I'm just going to go do the bitters?
Yeah, so any kind of history of acid reflux or heartburn, anybody who actually is celiac, just like E. coli, there are some very strong links. And again, we don't know who caused what between H. pylori and celiac. So I like to ask those people if they would take the 401H test. Any kind of malabsorption of, so if they've got like low iron or low B12, low B vitamins in general, low minerals, so anything like that that looks like they've got malabsorption or low stomach acid, anyone with low stomach acid symptoms, I would want to test that. Yeah.
So pretty much you're of the feeling like don't give them bitters or HCL, have them do an HCL challenge until you've ruled out that they don't have H. pylori. Okay.
Yeah, good. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So that's what they look like. And so those tails, yeah, they're pretty. Those tails are what make them like a spirochete where they can then hide.
Dig holes.
Yeah, so they can, by interfering with our stomach acid and by sometimes attacking our parietal cells. They can help to create an environment where we can't digest our proteins or absorb our minerals as well. And they can, you know, this just has a cascading effect over the whole digestive system, basically. They do make a lot of histamine. So that's another one that I didn't mention before. If there's a strong histamine connection with a client, I like to check for H. pylori.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And just to mention what Karen says, and this will reiterate that these tests we've shown do this, it's stool tests need to be done over several days to catch mm-hmm. all the shedding organisms. If you just do a one shot, it's unlikely to get it. Some of the labs do 3 days, some of them do four. I've even heard people say that what they do is they have people do capture on day one and two and put that in the day one vial and capture on day three and four and then put it in the day two vial. So they actually get it across like 6 or 8 days, depending on what you're doing. So that's another way to do it as well.
The more days, the better.
The more days, the better. Yep.
Yep. For sure. I think the doctor's data and the 401H are both supposedly over 3 days, but you can circumvent a system by
capturing it longer.
Stretching it out,
You just have to be able to explain that to your client, and if they're in a state of brain fog, they just lose it. So write it out, or else they're like, what? What do you want me to do?
Yeah. Definitely. And this taking a poop test, like, well, I think it's really fun for a lot of clients. Like, it's no laughing matter, right? Like, you know, we're making jokes about it, but, you know, people are sometimes really uncomfortable with this, and people don't know how to do it, and it's very intimidating, and there are a lot of instructions. So the more support that you can provide for people doing this, I think the better. So for H. pylori, biofilm disruptors are also really important because they can create a biofilm in the stomach there. Yeah, and actually this is another digression, but if they can move to whatever part of the stomach they want and they can create a biofilm, they're pretty smart little critters. So sometimes if we're just taking, you know, like a couple teaspoons of something and it's sitting in the bottom of our stomach and they've decided that they're going to move up into the side of our stomach and or the, you know, upper part of our stomach and bore and have a biofilm, you know, we're probably not going to be getting at them with a lot of different things. So that being said, some herbs that have been shown to be effective against spirochetes and H. pylori in particular, horse chestnut, neem oil and the powdered leaf, olive leaf, and celery seed. It was celery seed oil that was studied, and so actually carrot seed oil as well. So it just depends whether your client is comfortable ingesting that. Yeah, and antioxidants. H. pylori does not like antioxidants, in particular amla berry, just because that's such a strong antioxidant. But other foods like blueberries, pomegranates, sour cherry, goji berries, cilantro, cloves, turmeric, cinnamon, acai. So I know people have different issues with, you know, oxalates or with sugars. And so find the right thing for your client. But any really high antioxidant foods that you can include would be great. Meadow sweet tea is a really good one. And none of these would I do on its own. It's a complex organism. I would make sure to, again, they can become resistant. So I would make sure to kind of create a whole plan. So one of the current systems for dealing with H. pylori medically is to give someone a proton pump inhibitor to reduce their stomach acid and then give them three different antibiotics at the same time. And I've read different effectiveness of this protocol, but it's not more than 50% effective. And so, and it's pretty hardcore. You know, there was a really good study about liposomal vitamin C with a good group of people, and in 40% of the H. pylori cases, and they were eradicated with just doing 3,000 milligrams of liposomal vitamin C over a period of, I don't remember how many weeks, but I do believe it was between 4 and 6.
Okay.
I'll have to
so
post.
It should be liposomal versus just buffered C.
Yeah. I mean, we don't really know. I just know that's what was in the study. So, but you know, 40% effectiveness for just taking vitamin C, I think that's worth a shot.
I think it's certainly worth it, and you can just do it in conjunction with the other stuff. But one of the things that I use a lot that I didn't see you mention is mastic gum, and I've also tried Matula tea, which I'm not – the jury's out on that one.
Yeah, so the Matula tea is fine. It's got a lot of the herbs that we would use for H. pylori.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, Yeah.
Just expensive. It's bloody expensive, like $150 for a month's supply.
Yeah. So, and it's, they make it really hard to tell what the ingredients are, but meadowsweet is one of the ingredients in that tea.
Okay.
So, and mastic gum has been, like, it is very effective, or propolis if you are open to doing bee products. It's good to have something sticky for the reason being that we know H. pylori can move around and hide, and we were talking about if it's like kind of on the side or on the top, and we've got some liquid sitting in the bottom of our stomach. It's not, you know, just thinking about it, like logically, it's not going to be touching the H. pylori. It's not going to get there. So having something sticky that can coat the stomach, like mastic gum.
I'm sorry, I keep asking so many questions, but I think, you know, this is
awesome.
This is important stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. And hopefully people can come back to this and it'll be worth it. Yeah. Okay, so this is the part where we can talk about some of the really great, great things that are studied about the probiotics. I totally want to just have the caveat that most of these studies are done on particular strains. And so there's like the family, there's the species, and then there's the strain. And, you know, so what will happen is typically like Denon will get a patent on a strain, and then they'll do some studies, and then they'll publish some stuff, and then they'll come out with a probiotic supplement.
Mm.
And so while I totally agree that a lot of the benefits are strain specific. Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of.
And when you say strain, let's clarify. So if we have Lactobacillus plantarum.
And then there would be a number after it.
Number. That's the like DL, whatever, 40 or some of those others that are.
Right.
Okay. Got it.
Right.
Okay.
So most of these ones that I've chosen are ones where, like, you know, more than one strain of the same kind of, where I feel like there have been enough different strains that have kind of been shown to have similar benefits of the species that I feel like I can kind of go, well, we can either get the strain specific one or. So you can, when you're shopping for Lactobacillus plantarum, you can look for the one with the number after it. But I've seen enough studies showing that it can suppress skin infections that I'd be willing to just do the plantarum and see. Yeah. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah.
All right. So then the bulgaricus has been shown to suppress E. coli overgrowth, which we talked about before. And they're often found in, like, Greek yogurt. So if you're making your own yogurt, you can use the bulgaricus and have a really great flavor. They do produce D-lactic acid, just so you know. Yeah.
Okay. So you wouldn't do it if they're SIBO?
Brilliant. Yes, I wouldn't.
Okay.
So Lactobacillus gasseri suppress H. pylori overgrowth. So this would be a really good one to add to help to restore balance sometime while you're working on the H. pylori balance. Yeah, and the Lactobacillus species, they like to live in the small intestine, just lining the skin there. And so that's really important because the H. pylori can move into the duodenum. And then, yeah, okay.
Mm.
So Lactobacillus paracasei has been shown to have improvement in sinus infections. And there were many different strains of this one, many different studies that I've read showing that. So that's hopeful.
That's great.
Yeah. So then this is Acidophilus, and this is a particular strain, the LA5, again, suppressing H. pylori infections.
Great.
Yeah.
And then, of course, going back, you need to make sure that if they are D-lactic acid producing, that you avoid them with SIBO until you get the SIBO cleared up.
Totally. So with the D-lactic acid, the only ones that, in my opinion, are safe are Lactobacillus salivarius, Lactobacillus reuteri, and all of the bifidum. So there's still a lot you can do to restore balance, staying away from the D-lactic acid bacteria. Yeah, so Lactobacillus reuteri has been shown to enhance immunity.
Is that the one that's good for teeth?
Yes.
For gum?
Yep.
So for somebody who has a lot of gum infections and things in their mouth? Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Great.
Yeah, and they actually sell it in little kind of baby gum things that you can rub on babies' gums too.
Oh, wow.
So you can get it on its own pretty easily. So cool. So the bifidum and many, many different types of bifidum can help to reduce oxalates, as well as Lactobacillus plantarum, actually. So that's a good to note.
That's very good to know because a lot of people are sensitive and, you know, of course you got to heal the leaky gut and do all that, but it's good to know that taking the bifidum can help reduce the oxalates and those that are going to be absorbed and cause systemic problems.
Right. Totally. Yeah. It's super good if someone's taken the OAT test and their oxalates are high. Of course, you're going to work on creating those barriers to not go through to the body, but also work on having less oxalates in the intestinal tract to go through through this balance. Yeah. So the Bifidum Brev, reducing IBS symptoms. So the Lactobacillus fermentum, ME3, so this is a really new study. And so it's been shown to produce glutathione and also reduce cholesterol. And a lot of bacteria produce glutathione. But I know that the Lactobacillus fermentum is going to be sold on its own. So it might be a good choice for people who just can only tolerate a few things. And yeah, so I'm still not sure with the glutathione how much of it really, you know, I'm just not sure about the whole thing.
How much, yeah.
Yeah. And the E. coli produce a heap of glutathione as well, you know, but it doesn't make them good.
But it doesn't make them good, right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I'm assuming all these ones that you're sharing with us are actually available commercially.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So these pictures here, I did not put them here by accident. If someone comes to see you and the first thing that you think about is which bacteria to give them or which anything to give them, again, we've totally missed the point.
Right.
It's about restoring balance. It's about the basics. It's, yeah. And so it's not a free pass. Saccharomyces boulardii is not a free pass on eating burgers and not getting colon cancer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just really important to take the whole system into consideration and to really look at this functionally and to create a different way of looking at these probiotics, because again, it's becoming really popular. It's like the hot thing of 2016. And I really would like to hold the space to be looking at it in terms of the whole person, the whole system, looking at it functionally, never saying this for that. Yeah.
Exactly. Well said.
Thanks.
You're so funny. You know, and most people here are not saying thank you. They're going, but I want to see those 20 more slides. Those 20 more slides.
Yeah, there's so much more, but we really.
There's so much more to know.
So much here to go over.
Yeah. Yeah. So what does it say? Yeah. Go to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we put up a link on the page, and it'll be on the page when this is posted, to her 12 Bacteria Benefits ebook. So yeah. I can't read that. StephJackson.com/CMOS? CMDS. Ah, CMDS. That makes sense.
Yeah. So it's just forwards to your link.
StephJackson.com/CMDS. So it's just basically, we have the link on the sidebar.
Okay,
and we'll
good.
Have it on the page when this gets
posted
as well. Yeah. And you can get more information there.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to say thank you for having me, and thank you to everybody who stuck it out and everybody who's listening to this recording. I really want to build a community around this, and I want to, you know, be a part of this with you that we can take this knowledge further and really help people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so one thing I wanted to say was, you know, if you've enjoyed this with Steph, and she kept saying, there's so much more. She is in the process of creating a practitioner training program to go deeper with this. So it's like the next step after CMDS, where you got all, you know, the basics and the overviews and a lot of in-depth information, but she's going to go deeper with a lot of the stuff she talked about today. So that's something that you want to keep your eye on. So go to StephJackson.com/CMDS and sign up to get that book, right? There is a sign up there, right? So that she can communicate with you and let you know when she's releasing that. And we're hoping for February, March, when are you looking for?
Yeah, so I'm thinking the last week of February, or it seems to be on track for the last week of February.
Great. And some of the folks that registered for the whole NEPT program at the event that we had in the fall are actually bonused into that class, my treat. So
yay.
Yeah,
but it's keeping me accountable. So yeah, I'm edit out some more slides and get this program to you, because it's just, I think it's so important right now.
I think so too. I want to take it.
Cool.
So there are a few other questions. Sequoia asked, do you have suggestions for diantamoeba fragilis trophozytes?
Yeah, I would actually, I would try first those things that I mentioned, the papaya seeds, the pomegranate husk. I actually find that that guy and the Blasto are friends. Like, they're often together. It's probably just a coincidence, but
Yeah. So Michelle says, I have a client who's been on so many antibiotics from pneumonia as a baby, antibiotics as a burn at 7 years old, staph in her 30s. She's a ton of issues. Like, where do you begin? And she's going to put this on. She eats a clean diet, has determined she has a histamine issue. We just start with testing, and she's going to submit it for a case on the retreat day that we do in February.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I would like to be there. But I would start at the top. I would go back and I would think, how does the digestive system work?
Yep.
And I would start at the top. I would start at the stomach and I would start at the basics. And I definitely would test for H. pylori first. But you can, like, you can do this. You can do this and just take it one bacteria, one step at a time.
Yeah.
You can get them back to a place where they can then tolerate more bacteria and more foods. And it does require patience. It just does, but you can do this step by step.
And you know, one of the things that you start with before you even do the testing, I think, is you look back to the foods that harm, the foods that help the gut. You get them off of the gluten and the dairy and any allergens, and you know, all the basics we talked about at the beginning. Because you can't, like Jeff said earlier, you can't just do it this for that, right? If it's H. pylori, you do this. But if they're still eating a crappy diet and they're destroying their gut while and feeding their bacteria. So you start with that basic, all the dietary things, and then talk to them about testing and say, hey, I'd like you to start with the diet first, but we want to do some testing to see what's there. And in a case like this, where it's been so chronic, you can do the testing initially as well, but you got to get them started on the dietary pieces.
Totally. And I would also argue that without exercise, and adequate water and adequate sleep, the migrating motor complex, I believe, isn't going to be working properly.
Absolutely. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of people said, thanks, Jeff. This is awesome. I saw that all over both of the places where we're typing in. If you're 23, whoever you are, thank you so much. Great. I'm so happy. And Michelle, this was so awesome. Thanks, Jeff and Dr. Rita Marie.
Oh,
Tony says, fascinated. I'm interested in the advanced training.
Hi, Tony.
Lynn says, I'm interested too. Vanessa says, thank you, Jeff. You're 22, whoever you are. How do we print out the digital bacteria poster that comes with being on this call? What does that mean?
Yeah, because there was a poster that should be, I mean, there should be like a link to download it.
Okay, so it should be on the page, right? So it should say bacteria sheet, is that it?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. So
Rutger made it for me.
Oh, sweet. So if you go to the side of where we're, if you're on the live call, but on the if you're listening to the recording, it'll be on the page where this is posted. So it says bacterial sheet, and you just download that and you print it.
Yeah,
okay.
It's like bullet points of some of the benefits of the bacterial strains.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Great. Great job, Steph from Eleanor.
Cool.
She says Michelle says she already eats really clean. So like Steph said, I would, you know, start with testing the H. pylori and see what you go from there. And make sure what she says is clean is what you believe is clean based on the guidelines. Because a lot of people think they eat clean because they, you know, they eat whole wheat bread and eggs for breakfast. And then they have a sandwich on whole wheat bread for lunch. And, you know, they're still not eating and they're still hidden sugars because they're eating agave or coconut nectar instead of sugar. And so all of those things. But, yeah, she might be.
Yeah.
You were five, whoever you are. I have a friend who said that she eats a lot of veggies and is really healthy, but burps a lot afterwards. What do you think that could be?
I would look at H. pylori or blastocystis, to be honest.
Or eating too fast.
Or eating too fast. Totally. Yeah. Like, so all those things that I forget to say, notwithstanding, I would look for those two guys.
So I come from the place of look for the horses, not the zebras. When you hear horse beats, think horses, not zebras. And if it's not a horse, then you look for the zebra. So that's a common thing. They're gulping down their food. They're sitting at their desk. They're going, well, well, well. It's a great meal, but it ain't going anywhere because they're not eating it well.
I do have a client who has that same issue. And I you know, she's very stressed. And I do believe that that's the thing for her and the way that she's eating. It's the people part is an art.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's the thing with dealing with your clients is helping them to see and really helping them to slow down and do the breathing and appreciation before each meal, the shift into parasympathetic state. Because if you're eating in sympathetic state, you're not digesting, totally not digesting. So, yeah, a lot of this was awesome. What is mastic gum? Mastic gum, M-A-S-T-I-C. G-U-M. Yep. Yeah, look it up. There's a lot of different supplements. I use, like, there's one from Designs for Health that I like called, I don't know, Peptigard or something. No, that's cool. Thorn. There's one that they have that has that plus some other things in it. So you may want to look at that. And there's some plain, just plain old mastic gum.
Yeah. All the tree resins.
Yeah.
Just super quick. All the tree resins, mastic gum, frankincense, like, and ones that we haven't heard of, you know, like, local trees, like people here use cottonwood or whatever, right? So all the tree gums that would be in propolis, a lot of them have anti-H. pylori properties.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there was one last question. What about PPIs, people that live on PPIs? These drugs are addictive. People are have a hard time getting off of them. Proton pump inhibitors, for those who don't know what PPIs are.
It's super sad, actually, just to be totally honest, because I'm talking to you guys. It's super sad, you know, and I've seen a lot of people, some people, who have been on them for like 11 years and now, you know, are having a very hard time restoring their stomach acid. And some people say that it can permanently damage your ability to produce stomach acid. And I think that sucks.
Yeah. And, you know, what the sad part about it is that it's basic physiology and biochemistry, right? That when you really, when you look at disease, dysfunction, right? I like to look at it as dysfunction rather than disease. But when you look at that, if you understand the basic biochemistry, physiology, anatomy, then you don't just throw drugs at it. Like, you don't just say, oh, they have heartburn, so let's reduce the stomach acid. You say, why do they have heartburn? Is there really too much stomach acid? Could it be low stomach acid? You know, but that's not the way that it's taught in medical school. So that's why you see a lot of these just slap them up thing. Plus, they get 5-10 minutes with each person. So they don't necessarily have the time. So it's not the fault necessarily of the individual doctor. It's the fault of the system that's not training them right and that's not giving them enough time with their patient to actually get to know them and understand what all those underlying causes are. That's what we're here to shift. That's my mission is to shift that mentality, to teach as many doctors, nurses, people in the professions, as well as those of us who are alternative minded to begin with, really get into, understand your basics. That's why I spend every module that we do in NEPT. And in this module, we spent a lot of time. We had a module for each part of the digestive tract on anatomy. You know, it's really important. You don't have to memorize every little point and structure and nodule and all that, the names of them, that's not what's important. What's important is understanding the flow, understanding the physiology, and then understanding the endocrinology of the gut, which is a coming module that I'm working on. And I just keep working on these modules and I spend like way more time than I think I'm going to because there's so much great information, it's hard to weed it out. So that's what's coming up, the endocrinology of the gut. So when you understand all those pieces, it starts to click and you don't just rush to what herb for this or what drug for that or whatever. It's a mentality. So there's two different things that need to shift in our health profession as well as far as I see it, maybe more, but it's two main things, which is one is that mentality of this for that. Like, no, there's no this for that. It's look for the root cause. And we don't want to turn off the symptoms. Right. And really, we want to understand exactly how it works so that we know when something's going wrong, that we can understand it. So that was three. So there's probably a whole bunch more, but that's kind of the things that we're looking at changing. We want to spend time with people, get to know them, get to know all the confounding factors that might have gone into what's going on. And then we can help them and know that it's a slow process sometimes. Because we're unwinding and unraveling decades, usually, of imbalance. and it's going to take some time. It's going to take healing. Like symptom relief generally happens pretty quickly. You take the pill, it knocks out the nerve endings that go to that spot and you don't feel it. But we're not fixing it, right?
Nope.
Fixing it requires rebuilding and re-nurturing and restoring optimal function. And it takes time and it takes being a detective and really digging in. And like Steph pointed out in here, I highly recommend you listen to this again. But as she pointed out, there's like different things you have to take into consideration. If they have H. pylori, you don't want to do the stomach acid. And if they have this bug, you don't want to add this. So it's really like fully understanding it. And you will get it. It's a matter of going through it over and over. And that's why I highly encourage you to come to the case study call. It's an all day kind of 11. I think we're doing it 11 to 4 or something. So it's pretty much all day, or 11 to 5 central. So it's not too early for the West Coast, but we want to do that so that we're all coming together for a day. You can get any questions answered that you need to, but we're going to go over actual cases. Okay. So that's going to help cement it all in place as well.
Yeah.
So you were awesome, Steph. I will reiterate what everybody said. This was absolutely amazing. I highly recommend. Oh, I'm totally thrilled. Thank you for being here. I'm thrilled with what you offered and the depth and your caring and your knowledge. It's been amazing. So what I would say is that go and download her 12 probiotics thing. It's on the sidebar. And again, if you're listening afterwards, it'll be on the page. And just really, you know, stay in touch and go back and, you know, make sure you do the modules, each of them. Sometimes you have to do them a couple of times. You get the advantage by doing this way versus when I went to school and we did a 3-month course in digestion and you had to scramble and take notes. And if you missed anything, you had to read the book, but then you didn't always catch all the perspectives. I wish we would have been able to go back and watch these videos over and over, download the MP3s to your device that you carry around with you and do it while you exercise. And I highly recommend that you just immerse yourself in this and also be patient with yourself. Because you're not going to have the mastery of this overnight. It's not going to be overnight, but have patience with yourself. I'm looking to see if there's any last questions. And Michelle says, will the Steph's Practitioner Program be available to people outside NEPT? Yes, she will be offering it in general. I mean, you're probably going to screen and make sure people are capable of taking it. You're not going to just let every person do it for themselves.
Yeah, totally. I'm not really good at covering. Yeah, I'm not really good at covering like the basics. I tend to totally skip those. So
yes.
I need to be able to talk to people on a certain level. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, at some point, maybe we'll make this a prereq for it because this is a good prereq for it. No, any lay person, no, they'll be lost. Any lay person won't, unless they can go through this program that you're going through right now, this Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System, and get it, then they can go there. But the average lay person, I mean, there may be a few exceptions, and I'm sure Steph will be willing to look at a case-by-case basis of somebody who, you know, they have a degree in, you know, cellular biology. They probably could take it, right? So,
yeah, I think anybody who can really research and really cares about helping people and who's open-minded, but who understands the digestive system to start with.
You have to understand the digestive system to start with, because you're not going to go over all the basics again.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Laura just said she's going off to bed. Maura says, thanks so much. It was great. And thank you, Maura, for finding that DAO. And thank you, everybody. And thank you again, Steph. I'm just totally thrilled that you did this.
Yeah, thank you guys. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.